You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good evening again, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. This time, I'd like to invite the panelists and the director to join me. And feel free to come forward if you're so inclined. So I'd like to start now the formal part of this for what will be a relatively short panel discussion. And first, some thanks are in order. First, this event is a joint event of the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. My name is Nathan Sachs. I'm director of that center, along with the George Washington University, including Alia Dubnov over here, who's the Max Ticton Chair at George Washington University. So we're extremely grateful for that partnership and hope to have more in the future. This project also is very generously supported, has been supported over the past couple of years, both by the Israel Institute, and we're extremely grateful for their help, and by the Morning Star Foundation, who've been a longtime partner, and we're very grateful to them. So now, without further ado, while everyone catches their breath, how on earth did you get to this story? Well, how did you know you would start a journey and find all this evidence?
Well, the truth is that I didn't know. I was researching this terror attack because a friend of mine was there, and I wanted to make a film about the trauma he had. And but after 2 months into the research and into the process, my friend understood that he cannot go through this, and he quit. But I was already into the archives, and actually I saw that there were 4 different versions that went out to the public in the 12 first hours after the terror attack. And actually I was intrigued by the fact that I wanted to know how a story is built from the moment of truth, if there is one, till we as consumers at home, media consumers, get it. Like what are the stages that it goes through? So the first thing that I did is to give Jamal Barakat, the protagonist, a phone call and tell him who I was and what I'm going to do. And he told me, listen, I've been waiting for this phone call for 10 years. So then I knew that I'm going on this journey.
And going along, I mean, you seem to get a lot of people eager to tell the story, but at the center of it all is Jamal Barakat. He's told actually by Willie that you are suffering, which seems to be true. He really does seem to be going through a tremendous amount of difficulty. I should note his Hebrew is excellent. He seems to be very Israeli in many respects. He works for the Israeli government. His brother was a policeman. But here he's lied to, and he's lied to related to his identity. How is he today? What's happened with Jamal?
Well, actually, Jamal thinks that this film is only a stage, only a tool on the way to the truth. For him, the process is not finished yet. But he likes the film. Just before the broadcast of the film, there were several articles that went out, and there was publicity. And following that, one of the paramedics that were on the scene approached me. Immediately, what happened is that during the research, I've reached 150 people, but the paramedics wouldn't speak with me. But this specific paramedic, 2 years before the film was accomplished, he quit the force so he could speak. So immediately I put him on the radio in a primetime national broadcast in Razi Barkaif, you know. And he told everyone what he saw. He was the first paramedic on the scene. He knew Salim. There was an era of terror attacks, Black March 2002. He knew him from work. He immediately identified him on the scene, and he saw that he had a wound of a gun in his neck. He even showed it to his friends. that they would know how a wound like this looked like. And another thing he told on radio was that there was a panic man just standing beside the body and shouting, I shot someone accidentally. All this was not in the file. So I'm telling you all that because Jamal was very satisfied with that concerning his investigation. And the next thing that happened was that Druze, a parliament member, wrote a letter to the chief police and the general attorney demanding to reopen the file and to prosecute the people that covered up this file. You probably guess that there's no answer till now, but now it's going to the Supreme Court, and Jamal has to decide whether he's going to the next step.
Okay, one last question before I open to our two panelists. This came out in a very special time. You dealt with the Druze community. You had been working on this film for a long time, for years, but it happened to come out exactly when the nation-state law passed. Did you have conversations with Jamal about it, or was this present when things came out? Was this part of the atmosphere for the movie?
Thank you. It's a good question. The thing is that Jamal, I didn't have to... We didn't speak about that. Jamal, you know, he's due to two systems. He works like in two systems. On the one hand, he's a loyal Israeli that serves the government, and on the other system, he's a Druze that has his own beliefs. But I think from the place where he was standing, he couldn't see this conflict that was so interesting for me. And when we just got to this journey together, he couldn't understand, he couldn't believe that the government will lie to him. But I think that we can see that through the film, he's going through a process, and now he's in a different place. We didn't have to speak about it, you know. We're quite tuned together about this thing. Just 2 days before the premiere in Jerusalem Film Festival, there was the biggest protest ever of the Druze community in Tel Aviv, in Rabin Square, 50,000 people. So it's amazing how sometimes art predicts the reality. You know, I've been working on this film for 7 years.
Great, thank you very much. Let me briefly introduce our two panelists, and thank you again both for joining us. So immediately to Rami's left is a good friend from literally next door. Zaha Hassan is a visiting fellow here at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's also a human rights lawyer. You can see also in the material you've got. Research focuses on Palestine-Israeli peace and the use of international legal mechanisms by political movements. She was also herself a coordinator and senior legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team during their bid for UN membership and a member of the Palestinian delegation to the Quartet-sponsored exploratory talks in 2011 and 12. And she's, I can tell you as well, she's regularly featured in many publications and a very central participant in many efforts here in Washington. And so, Zaha, thank you very much for joining. To her left is Ari Dubnov. Ari Dubnov is the Max Tichton Chair for Israel Studies at the George Washington University. He was trained in Israel. He's previously taught at Stanford and at Haifa University in Israel, and was also a Mosse Fellow for quite a while at University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I think his son was born. He has written extensively on a variety of different issues, including nationalism, decolonization, and partition politics. And I'll just mention a couple of his publications. One is a intellectual history of Isaiah Berlin, and another edited volume, Zionism, A View from the Outside. Ari, I'm going to start with you. You were in Israel at the time when this movie came out, I believe. You actually saw some of the debates over the nation-state law. Where do the Druze sit in this? What do they mean for this debate?
Well, thank you, Rami. And first, I would really like to congratulate Rami for an outstanding movie and an important, you know, story about the importance of stories and the gap between stories and truth. So interestingly, while Rami was in Tel Aviv in the premiere, in Jerusalem, excuse me, for the premiere, I was in Tel Aviv in that. in that summer mass rally at Rabin Square in central Tel Aviv. And I think that it was very interesting to see how the mass demonstration, in a way, captured the duality in the Israeli, let's call it center-left at the moment. There were two messages that coincided sometimes in some conflict. One message that came very much from the organizers, that were not only members of the Druze community, but predominantly ex-officers in the police force and in the military, was a feeling that the nation-state bill created a new type of set of hierarchies, and that would challenge what was, in their view, I think, the main message, some sort of a bond of blood and sacrifice that the Druze have vis-a-vis the Jewish Israeli community. While many of the other people in the mass rally came with a slightly different message that said equality. It's not necessarily about Druze, non-Druze. It's about what was missing in the nation-state bill. It was never accompanied by any type of a bill of rights that states clearly, black and white, all citizens are equal, and then from there we will continue. It's not that these two messages were completely incompatible, but there was definitely a tension or a duality in even the immediate reaction. So it's very interesting, actually, that the movie indirectly talks exactly, kind of puts the finger on that duality.
How so? What do you think about the movie captures this?
Well, I think that the movie and really, I mean, Jamal with his piercing eyes and his deep inner conflict, you know, embodies it so beautifully and tragically. I think that even through the non-spoken parts, you know, you really see the Jews community as they're rooted in the deepest sense you can in the geography, in the place. I mentioned on purpose those things that are not spoken, the flowers, the diet. You know, they are the natives of the land. And at the same time, the really deep patriotism. Now, in a sense, for those of us who are familiar with Israeli history, this is an extreme case, but it's not the only, you know, study or this only case. Similar incidents happened in earlier cases. For those of you who are well-versed in Israeli popular culture, maybe they are familiar with the name of Yonatan Geffen. So he had a song called Ballad al Druzi, Ballad for the Druze, and it also tells a story about an elite commando unit kind of officer that under the, you know, the typical military winter coat and his Uzi, and it rhymes in Hebrew, no one knew that he's a Druzi, right? So through military conscription and volunteering, the Druze community bought itself a privilege or a special position in Israel, where most of the Jewish Israelis tend to look at things in a very binary Jew versus Arab, black and white pictures, and they don't really, the Jewish Israelis often don't know how to swallow it. You know, they prefer the Druze wearing the Israeli uniform, whether it's a police officer or a military officer. But suddenly when the Druze is in his quote-unquote natural habitat, there's a moment of uncanniness, in a sense.
So if I may, about the nation-state law, I mean, if we think of what happened there, the demonstration even against it, to play devil's advocate here for a moment, Israel was a Jewish state before that law was passed. Israel is not remotely the only nation-state law, nation-state in the world. Europe is replete with nation-states, official nation-states. What's the big deal?
It's a good question. I mean, as a historian, I'm approaching it as a story from a historical perspective, and there's the long history and the short history, and I don't want to go into the long history that has to do with, you know, the history of why Israel historically never had and the constitution, though those of you who are familiar with the Israeli Declaration of Independence will, if you read it carefully, it states very clearly that the state should have had a constitution. There were negotiations about constitution. That's, if you'd like, the quote-unquote long history. The short history, as I call it, I think very much is connected to the topic of, or at least the period, the phase that movie is connected to. I think it's the late 1990s and the 2000s. Basic laws is a very awkward mechanism, legal mechanism that Israeli developed in the absence of a constitution to create something which is sort of a piecemeal work towards constitution. Historically, of course, you know, you're absolutely correct, Natan, that nation state is Israel was established as a nation state. It was established at a time that nation state was seen as the clear way of redesigning global order after World War II. But the constitution, a lack of constitution, meant that how exactly you balance the democratic versus Jewish components in Israel was kept in vague and purposely so. There were a series of other basic laws that we tend to forget about. For instance, it was interesting to see that a lot of the attention about the latest nation state bill focused around the special status of Jerusalem, which was definitely one of the clauses in the bill, though there was a nation state law, passed by Menachem Begin that already stated that Jerusalem is an Israeli capital and so on. Some part of what happened in Israeli history in this way or the other is that often basic laws were sometimes seen as bargaining chips of different political parties. So, and I think that part of what we see recently, and I would read the last basic law, is a bit as a reaction to developments of the 1990s. During the previous nation basic law that was passed under Aaron, at the time that Justice Aaron Barak was the president of the Israeli Supreme Court, was moving Israel in a more liberal, democratic
position. This is the basic law for human dignity.
Absolutely. This is more about perception, slogans, and discourse than legal hard facts. But the perception in the public was that was very much connected to the mood of the 1990s, to the Oslo Accord, the feeling that Israel is moving towards a more liberal, hopefully a peace process. And part of what we see, I think, this is at least my analysis, is the Jewish Israeli public is deeply scarred after the atrocious attacks of the Second Intifada, the narrative of no partner on the other side very much captured, and also sort of a look at the 1990s as those wild years in which a liberal deep state was running the show. And part of what you see in the latest basic law is a bit as an attempt to block some developments that you saw in the 1990s, attempts of to greater calls for equality, the politically correct way of saying it is Palestinian citizens of Israel that are asking for more equality to be accepted to Jewish neighborhoods and settlements and inside the pre-1967 green light borders. And so on, the recent law will make it much harder for them to look for equality, which is exactly the opposite from the developments of the 1990s.
Great, thank you. Zaha, I'd like to turn to you. So first, just any reaction you have to the movie. We actually participated, the two of us, on a panel after a movie, and so it's interesting. They're quite different movies. But reactions to the movie, but also, if I may, this movie centers quite a bit about a dilemma of someone who's sort of liminal, of a small community, the Druze community is small, in between most Arabic speakers in Israel, who are Palestinian citizens of Israel, or Arab Israelis, depending on how they define themselves, and the Jewish community. For the majority of the Arabic speakers, for Palestinian citizens of Israel, really, is anything new? Did they think Israel was not? I mean, did they have any aspirations that were sort of broken by this, or do they just think this exposes reality?
Well, first, I just want to thank Rami for this film because it, beyond the content of it, I just can't believe how you were able to take us on a journey of discovery with, I'm just forgetting his name now.
Jamal
taking on this, because I'm thinking of Salim, taking us on this journey with Jamal, and we are discovering this with him, and we're feeling. I mean, it was hard to watch because you felt everything he was feeling, and of course he's got a whole different sense to it, but you really felt what he was going through. I don't know how you did that. I don't know how you set this movie up and got everyone to allow you to put them on film. So on that level, I'm just amazed, and I congratulate you on that. You know, the first thought that I had, it was before we even saw any visuals and the description of, the Druze community as, you know, an Arab community, as if Druze are a nationality or something separate than Palestinian citizens of Israel in general, or Palestinians, the Palestinian people as a whole. I mean, Druze are, you know, people of a particular faith community, just like Palestinian Christians are a particular faith community, and similarly for Muslims. There are Circassian Palestinians that live in Israel. There are, you know, Bedouins. It's a lifestyle. It's not a separate identity. They're all Palestinians. And I think, you know, that's a really important point that was brought home in your movie, that regardless of your status, citizenship, whether you're living under occupation or as a citizen of Israel, I mean, the Palestinian identity is there. And you're not going to escape it just because you carry a passport, you know, an Israeli passport. So, I mean, that really hit me. But I have to say that even among Palestinians, there was a reluctance after 1948 to identify as Palestinians. There were many Palestinians that wanted to identify as Israeli Arab because they thought that will enable them to assimilate into Israeli culture rather than be seen as the other, as their counterparts inside the occupied territories are seen by the Israeli government, the Israeli military. So it was around October 2000, after 13 Palestinians, 12 of whom were citizens of Israel, were killed and not, you know, they were unarmed and in a protest in solidarity with Palestinians that were protesting in the occupied territories in Jerusalem. They were killed by Israeli police, and there was no accountability for those killings. And it was after that time that Palestinian citizens of Israel started thinking about identifying with the Palestinian nation, because they really felt otherized by the way the Israeli police treated them, just as Palestinians are treated by the Israeli military in the occupied territory. So that sort of change in the identification of Palestinian citizens of Israel as Palestinians happened just around this time that you're talking about this particular story of Jamal and his brother Salim. So I think so that kind of jumped out at me too. But I want to go back to the Jewish nation state law, because it really brings full circle the whole presence of Palestinians in their historic homeland, because it isn't just focused on Palestinian citizens and denying them equality inside Israel. There's three provisions of the law that I think are really important because of how they operate separately and together. The first provision basically says that only Jewish people have a right to self-determination, or they have an exclusive right to self-determination in the state of Israel. Now, the state of Israel is not, we don't know what the borders of the state of Israel are, but within the state of Israel, Jewish people have an exclusive right to self-determination. Then there's a second provision that says that Jewish people have a historic homeland in the land of Israel. Now, the land of Israel, what is the land of Israel? It's the biblical Israel. It's Judea and Samaria. It's and beyond. So it's the occupied territories and beyond. And then the third provision says that it's a national priority for Israel to expand and consolidate settlements. So if you read those three things together, what's being said is that only Jewish people will have a right to self-determination anywhere Israel extends its sovereignty. So when Israel declares its border and extends its sovereignty into the occupied territories and various places, we don't know how that's going to come out. But Israeli settlers are going to have priority over Palestinians living in the occupied territories because they don't have that historic national home the way Jewish people have. So they're going to be denied their right to live in their indigenous homeland. Similarly, Palestinian citizens of Israel, they don't have equal rights to self-determination in that same territory. So they can be actually have their citizenship revoked if there was ever a reason to do that, and if the Israeli government ever found a reason why they would want to revoke. And we know that they've talked about that actually. In negotiations in 2007, Zippy Livni, the Israeli foreign minister at the time who headed negotiations, actually talked about forced population transfer as part of a peace agreement between the Palestinians and Israelis. So up to 300,000 Palestinian citizens of Israel would be denaturalized and become part of a Palestinian state. And this was something that was raised during negotiations. So when we look at the Jewish nation state law, we have to take it in this context, and also understand that it's not just a product of a particular moment in time when we have an Israeli society that's veering very much towards the right. The idea of a Jewish state and Palestinian recognition of Israel as a Jewish state was not something that was ever proposed to them early on in negotiations or early on when Israel was founded. There was never a demand. It only became a demand after October 2000 and those events happened, and Palestinian citizens of Israel started to say, we want equality. And they issued a vision statement in which they envisioned an Israel in which everyone lived with equal rights, where Palestinian indigeneity was recognized, where there was an end of occupation, but a two-state solution. But they wanted equality, and they wanted a constitution that guaranteed them equality. And it was that moment where we started seeing Ariel Sharon talk about Palestinians, recognition of the Jewish state, Israel's a Jewish state, and then we saw Ehud Olmert in 2007 during Annapolis talks demanding that Abu Mazen, as a precondition to negotiations, recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And now we have Netanyahu expanding it further, saying, no, it's a recognition of a Jewish national home in Israel. So it's I don't know what the effect of that difference is, but it's changing. But the idea is that the only people that have a right to live between the Mediterranean Sea and that strip of land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River are Jewish people. And so this is the dilemma that was so wonderfully put on film for us, because you saw that wrenchingness from Jamal in trying to, negotiate between his feeling of connectedness to Israel as a state, but also, to his own community, it was a really painful thing to watch.
So I want to push back a bit on the interpretation of the nation state law, because certainly its proponents in the main would disagree with the characterization. In particular, the argument would be there, at least for those of them who would support a two-state solution, that the idea that Israel as a state, there would be exclusive national rights for the Jewish people is fully consistent with the idea that there would be a Palestinian state, Palestine, in which Palestinians would have national rights and Jews would not. Those who'd want a one state, that's a different question. That probably would fall into how you described it. But wouldn't a nation state, what you're describing, couldn't you by extension say that about any nation state in Europe? What is it about this law that makes it different?
Well, first of all, Israel was never an ethnically pure state. Israel came into being because it colonized the historic Palestine, and there was an indigenous people there. So to all of a sudden say now we're going to recognize it as a Jewish state denies that history, denies that indigeneity, and that's the problem. But the other issue with the nation state law is, like I said, you know, Israel hasn't even declared its borders yet. And there's the other provision that makes a national priority expansion and consolidation of settlements. And the provision that describes the area at the land of Israel as the historic homeland of the Jewish people, it doesn't leave room for Palestinians anywhere, you know, anywhere within that historic Palestine.
Okay, we can get back to that. There might be questions. I want to turn to a more informative question. You described how Palestinian citizens of Israel see themselves in this transformation towards identification as Palestinians. There seem to be two contradictory processes going on. On the one hand, the process that you described, but on the other hand, also growing tendencies among many of them viewing themselves as wanting to be part of Israeli society. Certainly, socioeconomically, there's been dramatic improvement in actually recent years. And now we've seen leadership among them, most notably Ayman Odeh, who was the head of the joint list, which is predominantly Arab, sounding very different, speaking about participating in the Israeli political system, going really on a limb with some of his own party members even. So I wonder, the two things can, of course, coexist. You don't have to resolve them. But I wonder how this relates to relations of Arabs or Palestinians inside Israel and those in the territories. Have relations changed recently because of this law or because of the rise of leaders like Ayman Odeh or others? What is his position in the territories?
It's a great question. Most Palestinian citizens of Israel actually support a two-state solution, and it's not that they're talking about a one-state solution. They're talking about a two-state solution, but they're talking about a two-state solution in the context of equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, the right to return for Palestinian refugees, and the recognition of Palestinian indigeneity in Israel, and they're asking for an end of occupation. In fact, this was their vision document. That's what their vision document described. There are Palestinians that live in the occupied territory, little less than half don't support a two-state or support a two-state solution. 50% don't support a two-state solution. There's a lot of disagreement between Palestinians and among Palestinians about a political solution. But one thing all of them agree about is that rights need to be respected, that Palestinian citizens of Israel need equality, that refugees have the right to return and should have the choice of whether to return, and they're entitled to reparations, and they want to see an end of occupation. So on that, there's no conflict. But your question about the joint list, Ayman Odeh, it was a very strategic move on his part, because it's true, Palestinians really want to be a part of the Israeli government inside of Israel. They think that they'll have more power over their lives, and they'll be able to make decisions in this, at least in the social and economic sphere, if they can be part of the government. And Ayman Odeh, the head of the joint list, picked up on this idea and wanted to get the vote out. And this was a way for him to really get the vote out by saying, by sending signals to say, yeah, I would be in favor of joining the Israeli government. But what wasn't highlighted in his remarks was these requirements that he wants to see the Jewish nation state bill repealed. He wants to see full equality for Palestinians and all the other asks that are part of the Palestinian. But he was very successful because he increased a Palestinian voter turnout for the elections by indicating that he would be in favor of joining a coalition government.
Okay. I'm going to let our others also respond, but I first want to open up to some questions from the audience if anyone wants to jump in now. I request that first you wait for the microphone. Secondly, identify yourself. And third, if you would ask a question, a short question with a question mark at the end, please. Any hands? Don't be shy. Then I'll go first. Rami, any response to what you heard? Can you tell us a bit more about how it looks to you? How do you think this relates to
what
you
did? Well, this was So interesting to hear both of you. Well, the thing is that, you know, it's black and white. Like, he was discriminated because he is a Druze. I think that goes out in the film. And another thing is that is the conflict that, on the one hand, in his own eyes, he is like an Israeli. But and if you would ask to Jamal if he's Palestinian, if you would tell him that he's Palestinian or Arab, he will say, no, I'm not Palestinian or I'm Israeli. But on the second hand, he speaks Arabic. So once he doesn't wear his uniform, that's the way he's being treated as Arab. And as all of us probably know, speaking Arabic in Israel is not doesn't bring you well. You can elaborate on that, but yeah.
Arik, do you think the nation state bill? I mean, how would you respond to Zaha's point about the nation state law and the possibility of a two state solution in it? Does it preclude it? Is it fundamental? I mean, you've done a lot of comparative history also on this. Does this stand out compared to other nation states?
I mean, I think that a lot of the part of the challenge here is that we will be able to measure the real impact of the nation-state bill in the future once we will have specific dilemmas that the court will have to judge vis-a-vis that law and how it will be interpreted by specific judges. There's many clauses that are really open to interpretation and are vague, describing Arabic. Again, the question of language is very interesting. And again, the dedicated entire clause to languages and Arabic before the law was one of the official languages. Now it has a special status. The law doesn't recognize this word, special status. What is the meaning of special status? Will have to be determined on the ground. Most people will say that this automatically discriminates Arabic. There were few, minority, but including in the Palestinian and Israeli community, that says, oh, maybe that's actually an opportunity to make now a law that will say that Israeli pupils in elementary school will start learning Arabic. That will be a huge advantage. I think that from a very dry legal perspective, part of the problem is, of course, we don't know what's the future of the entire region between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. At this moment, of course, the initial state law applies only to the Israel in the in its green light line borders and the areas that were annexed in the Golan Heights. The part of the, I think that, you know, to respond to your comment, one of the real points that I think that even if we will, so to speak, think about what in often for a liberal Israelis would be a good future two-state solution, if the nation-state bill remains as is, even within the Jewish state, and the law has too many potential discriminatory implications. So even if we will have this two-state solution that a larger number of people are saying is no longer workable, it's maybe an utopia, it's maybe a dream, even if we will establish it, if within that Israeli Jewish state the nation-state law is enacted in a very literal sense, we're in a problem because we do create a discrimination. And of course, Ayman Odda, of course, one of his demands was, of course, this will be called into, you know, there will be a legislative action to alter it, if not cancel it, altogether. I think that this is also a very interesting moment in Israeli history. It often was argued, it's partly a cliche, but partly true, that historically the Palestinian Israelis did not come and vote in masses in the national elections, though they were extremely well, you know, participated extremely well when it came to municipal
lecturers, because they felt that this is what will really impact their lives. And knowing how the Israeli coalition system worked, they will be always marginalized. The Jews will always find some sort of a coalition that would not include them. They will always find a bypass. So there is something very interesting. I'm not saying encouraging because I'm not an optimist, but there is something very interesting in the moment where witnessing now that maybe is signifying a change. Whether this means that all Arab-speaking communities in Israel automatically subscribe to a larger Palestinian nationalist cause, yes or no, we need to do the polling. I won't be surprised. I mean, you know Jamal Barkat personally, so I can't speak for him, but you will find members of the Jewish community, and sometimes even Bedouins who are serving in the Israeli army and police, that somehow, and this is part of the toxic elements of the occupation, sometimes they can be very ruthless in confrontational situations, that they won't subscribe so easily to see themselves as Palestinians. You will have a very a serious pushback, and they will say that you're confusing my religious identity and traits, but nothing is fixed. And the Bedouins are also feeling increasingly marginalized, so it changes their traditional political standing. So things are not fixed. I agree with that.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask a question.
Robin Horn. I wanted to ask a question about the access that you had as the director and the creator of the film, access that started with a certain perspective and a certain understanding and a way in which you saw how the film was going to develop, the story was going to evolve. And over time, that you learned more, and Jamal learned more, and your kind of the ability that you had to have interviews with people who a number of whom said they don't want to be interviewed, but they still somehow allowed the sound engineer to be there recording what they were saying. How did that evolve over time, and how did you maintain that ability in towards the end to show the film to the police, to the Israeli police, and get that reaction and get that understanding, and again, a different point in time, the information that you had was very different than where you started. So that was a long and winding question.
It was a long question, but in a lot of questions. But I can summarize it asking how did I get the access and how could I show it afterwards in the end? So about the police, I've started the first scene that you saw in the police station. I came to shoot as the photographer of the family. I was documenting the ceremony. It was very easy. But the moment the officer stood up and said that there was no armed citizen on the scene, and so I immediately understand that there is a cover-up. Then I started to shake, you know, and I didn't know how I'm going to get out of the police station. But it was amazing to see how easy it was to get into the end out with the camera, you know. So this was with the police. So the thing is that these guys in the police, and I think it's something that categorizes that. It's in a lot of security systems like this that they have this narrative of heroism and myth, and they cannot even imagine a different narrative, you know? So, like, showing a proof that they lie in a ceremony in a memorial ceremony is like putting a bomb in a police station, you know? And so it was a knockout. They were... Now, the people that covered up, and some of...
That you support putting bombs in any...
No. Now, the thing is that the people that covered up, they understand that that's for the second question, if they will try to resist the movie, the Pandora box that is going to open, and I know that, is much bigger than what you saw in the film. So it's better for them to keep quiet. You know, if they could, and you saw it on the disclaimer, they would have knocked me down, but they can't. And as for Willie, I think in a way all of us keep secrets, and it's not easy to keep secrets. People, they want, it's a burden, you know, they want to let go of this burden. And Willie is an interesting character because he holds two characters within him. On the one hand, as he says, he really wants to speak. But on the other hand, he's really frightened to speak because somebody told him not to speak. Did I answer the question?
Yeah. Yes, sir, in the back, and then we'll come here.
My name is Jeff Benek. Two-part question. Is this the first time you've shown the film in the U.S.?
No.
Okay, that leads to the second question. How much blowback are you getting from right-wing Zionists who refuse to allow an alternative picture of the way the Israeli government treats non-Jewish citizens in Israel? We've had problems here in Washington with exactly that kind of situation.
Well, there were four screenings in the U.S. till now, in Long Island, Boston, and Chicago, and this is the fourth. And I think that maybe right-wing people don't go to film festivals. Everybody likes the film, but I would love to speak with someone that wouldn't like the film, because in Israel it happens to me a lot that people don't like the film, and I like to argue with them. And if somebody wants to argue with me now, I will be happy to do that.
Has anyone ever restricted showing the movie in Israel?
No, no, no.
Has the police tried to come after you afterwards in any way?
No, no.
Have you? So actually, changing a moment to an interesting question about Jamal. You know, he wants to uncover the truth. It seems like almost an obsession. I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's an obsession. He's obviously suffering. Are there others who don't, from his family, his community? Are there others who say, look, however he died, you know, let it be?
Yes. That's a good question. Yes, many people, you know, it's like a status quo, and people are sometimes afraid to touch a status quo because it could be burning. It's like touching a wound in a way. And Jamal, in a way, you're right. It's an obsession. For him, on the one hand, it was really difficult to touch the wound. Sometimes we had to wait for 6 months so we can meet again after he would recover from a shooting day like that. But many people say, especially in the Druze community, don't touch our relationship with Israel because it might be worse, you know. We're happy where we are. I have to admit that till now, most of my screenings are not in the Druze section of Israel. It's for Jewish people. When I come back, I will have a screening in a high school in a Druze village, and I'm really looking forward for the screening to see how it is going, how they're going to react to this. So that's really new.
Yeah. Sir, please.
For Zaha. I'm David Rabin. You speculated or you described a little bit about the feelings of Israeli-Palestinians about a two-state solution. I wonder if you could expand on that in terms of the different Palestinian groups and the idea of a one-state solution, particularly within the light now of a national law that raises a lot of unsettled questions.
Yeah, I think this has become a really big issue after the Jewish nation state law that Palestinians, as fragmented as they are, you know, inside of, you know, even inside of the occupied territories between Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, and inside Israel, and in the diaspora, and Arab host countries that have refugee, Palestinian refugee populations, it's become an issue now to rethink, you know, what is the political solution that we should be fighting for, that we should be promoting, because the two-state solution looks so, you know, unlikely. A one-state solution also looks unlikely if you're talking about a state for all its citizens in Israel, right? Especially after the Jewish nation state law was passed. So this kind of debate and discussion is going on. And as you can imagine, depending on your life experience as a Palestinian, you're going to have different ideas about this. I mean, after Oslo in 1993, a lot of Palestinian refugees felt really dismissed and disregarded, and they weren't really supportive of the two-state solution because they understood that the likelihood of them returning to their homes inside of Israel and to reparations was going to be not in the offing. It was, if there was going to be return, it wasn't going to be in the numbers that they wanted. And so there was always that divide. Palestinian citizens of Israel, as I said, you know, the vision document that I was referring to earlier, that supported the two-state solution, that came out in 2007. And, you know, that was very much grounded in the idea that, you know, Palestinian state, state of Israel, but not a state of Israel that defines itself exclusively for Jews, obviously, because where would that leave the Palestinian citizens? And it also couldn't be a state that didn't recognize in the indigenous rights of Palestinians and would exclude Palestinian refugees. Palestinian refugees have no other state to go to. I mean, the ones that are living in the camp, they're stateless. And the only state they have a legal right to return to is the state of Israel, because that's where they originated from. No Arab country is obligated to extend citizenship to them. So that solution is not available to them, and it isn't the one that they prefer. So so that's why the Palestinian citizens of Israel, their vision document looks at a comprehensive solution, but within a two-state framework. So, it, you know, Palestinian state doesn't have to be an ethnically pure state either. But the idea is that people should live in equality. And as you can tell us from your, you know, your research on partition, even the partition plan back in 1947, it didn't envision an ethnically pure state. It described a Jewish state and an Arab state, but even in the Jewish state, the Jewish population was only a slight majority compared to the Palestinian population that was going to be living among them. And there was supposed to be a guarantee of democracy and that there would be rights protected for the citizens of either state. So there wasn't going to be an ethnically pure state even under the partition plan. So this idea of you know, having to define the state of Israel as a Jewish state is really a new concept that came out, like I said, as a reaction to you know, what was happening on the ground inside of Israel with the Palestinian citizens of Israel starting to awaken to the fact that they weren't being treated as equal citizens, and then talking about, you know, the need to respect refugee rights. That became very threatening to Israel. And then we started hearing this idea of, no, you have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state to Palestinians, something that was never required of any other state in recognizing Israel and establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. No other state was required to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, but Palestinians, they had to recognize Israel as a Jewish state.
If I could just push back for a moment, the way the Israelis usually describe the evolution of their demand for recognition of the Jewish state, which started not with Netanyahu, but actually on the left with Tzipi Livni, as you said, was not at all in reaction to anything about Palestinians inside Israel. It was about the demand for a right of return into Israel. And basically, it was framed as, if we are going to a two-state solution,
that necessitates one of them be Israel, not one be a Palestine and one be also a Palestine, but rather one be a Palestine and one be Israel. And if that's the case, a full right of return with 7 or 10 million refugees and their descendants returning is inconsistent with that. So it would be consistent with a one-state solution. There you could have a right of return for everyone and anyone. But if it's a two-state solution, it could not be. It would be based on two nation states and therefore a demand for recognition. So Tzipi Livni, who's on the left, was the first actually to raise it as a big demand as a response or as an argument for the right of return. Hence, not requiring it of Egypt or of Jordan, because Egypt did not demand that Egyptians move to Israel. Palestinians did.
Okay, so on Tzipi Livni, though, if you look at what she said that the Jewish state and the Palestinian state would be the complete end of all claims for Palestinians everywhere, including Palestinians of other states, holding citizenship of other states. So what was she referring to? She's referring to Palestinian citizens of Israel as well.
No, she meant as Palestinians living in Lebanon.
But then she also raised the idea that, you know, we could cede territory.
I'm sorry to push back, but I've asked her about this.
Okay.
It's categorically not how she sees it. Maybe you interpret it differently.
Not how she sees it. Well, I mean, but it can be interpreted that way. And that's the problem, because also the Jewish nation state law, you can also see all of that unfolding in the language of the Jewish nation state law in those three provisions that I talked about. But the idea, as I said, of a recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, it came with Ariel Sharon following his provocative visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the Second Intifada being launched following that and those killings in October of Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then the demands that were made and the accountability that was asked for those deaths, and they weren't forthcoming. If you look at Ariel Sharon, where he included this, it was in the Quartet Roadmap, and he put it. It was included in his reservations to the Quartet Roadmap in 2003. And what he wrote was that, you know, there had to be recognition of Israel as a Jewish state and Palestinian waiver of the right to return. There was an and there. And why the redundancy? It wasn't a redundancy. He was talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel. That's why he wanted Israel to be recognized as a Jewish state and a waiver of the Palestinian right to return. Now, it was picked up again by Olmert. Before the Annapolis talks started, he started bringing up this issue of recognition as a Jewish state, and then Tzipi Livni brought it up as well during negotiations. But Ariel Sharon was reacting to what was going on during the Second Intifada.
I'll remain a chair, not resist the urges. Ari, please.
I just wanted actually to bounce off, you mentioned partition, and I think that this is maybe an indirect or convoluted way to go back to your question also, Nathan, about a larger perspective. I think that part of what would maybe help us make some sense of the current mess is really to see Israel-Palestine as a post-partition space, and this is also very much similar, and this is part of what I'm arguing recently is, you know, if you want, look also at developments in India today. It's another post-partition space. Now, part of what you see, the developments you see under Narendra Modi in India today, relative, again, nothing is perfect in nation state in India after 1947, but it was still some sort of a clear minority status and toleration. A treaty of minority toleration, special status for Kashmir, things that were still very clear that there is a Hindu majority or a Hindu hegemony in India, but now they are challenged. Suddenly things that would be considered unheard of, suddenly you have Indian troops moving into Kashmir after years. I think that if you look at this not simply as a similarity that comes from nowhere, and you compare it with a larger phenomena that we call populism, you see suddenly the special relationship between leaders like Benjamin Netanyahu and Narendra Modi. You know, those of you are familiar, when Narendra Modi came to Israel, you know, he didn't get only the regular kind of diplomatic treatment. Bibi Netanyahu and Narendra Modi walked down the beach with an army of journalists taking photos of them as if they are a couple on a honeymoon. I mean, with Bibi in with both, you know, standing with their up to their knees in the Mediterranean, thinking about the future of their regions. Look, I think that I'm a historian. I'm not a policy thinker. I'm not the position of so many people here in the Brookings to whisper in the ears of policymakers. But I think that my bet is, if you want to have a larger perspective and see where things are coming, see these two countries and two post-partition spaces in tandem. Developments you see in each one of those places sometimes foreshadows or maybe is a precedent for the other. I think that this is and there you see also sort of a new, much less tolerant, much less inclusive discussion that is coming in the gaze of populism, which is India for the Hindus, like Israel for Jews.
So I can take one more question, if it's promised to be a very brief one. Is it? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Bill Dury, Mr. Katz, first of all, this is a tremendous effort. Thank you very much. I just wanted your opinion. Had the correct narrative come out at the time, what do you think the local reaction would have been?
It happened many times. Stories like this, there were many stories like that. And I think that, are you asking on the personal level or on the national level?
Explosive
no,
situation.
I think that
was the rationale of the police. This is a tragedy.
It is a
tragedy. These folks are heroes. We're trying to avoid a bigger local issue, or is there a bigger conspiracy here? I mean, it seemed to me that they were. You could argue that this was a tragedy, and we're trying to avoid this becoming something bigger.
Well, if they would have told the truth when it happened, first of all, I couldn't make this movie.
A fair point.
I think that it's a lie that, you know, like a snowball. In the beginning, like, actually, what you're asking, if I'm correct, tell me if I'm correct, is what's the motive to the lie, in other words? So, well, on the local level, Salim was undercover. He was wearing a civilian, he wasn't wearing uniform. He was waiting for car thieves to catch. And he was the first to arrive to the scene with no uniforms. And what he should have had on those days, and today also, is a hat in his pocket saying police. But what happened was that there was a lack of hats in the unit. And it was so obvious. It was so obvious that even after the terror attack, Jamal doesn't remember it. And this is another interesting thing. I found out that he contributed 500 hats to this unit, so they won't have any lack. And if someone in this unit, if this thing would go out, so somebody in this unit, a commander, maybe a commander that you saw in the film, would have paid the price for this
mistake. This problem.
Mistake, you know? So that's where it started. And then when it continues, so it was in the middle of, if you take it on a long shot, it was in the middle of the second intifada. You don't want your policemen and soldiers that speak Arab to get to the other side against you, you know? You want to keep them with you. You can't say to the public that he was killed because he looked like an Arab. That was the effect, you know? We cannot argue for that. So But in a way, I think that in their perspective, in their point of view, maybe they thought that they were doing something good to the family. They were taking responsibility on the family, you know?
Ami, any last words? What's the big takeaway for you? You're now onto other projects. What stays with you from this? Any life lessons? Truth, always wear a hat.
Always wear a hat. I'll go with that.
So please join me in thanking our panelists, Ari Dubnov and Zaha Hassan, and especially Director Rami A. Katz. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming. And thank you all. Have a good night.